is the most resilient? Is it me who has to go shopping in like in a shop because I'm not growing my own food, or is it them who like are absolutely, it doesn't matter if all the shops are closed, they are growing their own food anyway. They are totally autonomous. They are not waiting for decisions to be made outside because they have this like decision making process going on in a village that works really well and is pretty much horizontal. All of those things really shows that they just have a resilience that we don't have, and we need to learn from them and not the other way around.
Buenos dias. Welcome to Eco Village Library. I am your host, Christopher Kinney, and thanks, Michael, for the tunes, and thanks, everybody, for tuning in. This episode is going to be about creating an eco village, or about an eco village in transition based in West Africa and Guinea. And this, I bring a very special guest. Her name is Ade. She is based out of France, but she has spent time in that region and have learned about the development of eco-villages in regards to one community in particular. I had a fantastic time learning from her and hearing about her experiences there and her reflections and accounts from being involved in that region. But before we begin, I would like to touch base on some of the fundamentals, or you could say the fundamental principles of creating an eco-village or designing an eco-village. And basically, you could start by dividing them up into four different categories, which are known as the four keys of eco-village design. And first, well, none really goes in any particular order, but you have it broken down in the social element, the economics element, the ecological element, and the worldview or cultural element. So if we take a quick look at each one briefly, you know, in the social element, you'll see archaeological evidence, which shows the primordial social pattern for human beings to gather together in relatively tight-knit, egalitarian, clan-sized bands closely coupled with nature for many, 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 many years. Or in other words, enduring very tough circumstances together, banded together, always depending on one another. And now when we look at the economic component of designing an eco-village, how can we maintain what's produced, consumed, and all the economic activity that is happening in the given community? How can we maintain as much as that wealth within the community? So here it's important to have a vibrant and locally based alternative currency. For example, when I learned eco-village living and design in Finhorn Eco-Village in Scotland, they operated using their own created currency, which worked fantastically well. And every creation comes with its problems, just like with anything else. But comparatively, it was a success in my eyes, and it was awesome to see and use to actually make a purchase for goods and services with that local currency, and even also going out of the town to, I remember getting a cider for a couple echoes. That was their, the name of their currencies. And so even the surrounding towns were starting to accept it, which was quite remarkable. And also from this realm, we get social enterprises, which is a growing feature of eco-villages, which are engaged in providing employment to the marginalized or disadvantaged, which also at the same time restores degraded ecosystems or providing for community needs, providing childcare, care for the elderly, supply of healthy organic food, and while also making a reasonable profit, and of which will be banked in the community in the local currency. All the while living within the means of the bioregion in which resides the community. And so that, you know, ties into the ecological realm and basically creating a sense of place, creating a good livelihood that is healthy for everybody. So instead of busting your butt to work for a McMansion and have a nice Ferrari car that, you know, consumes lots of energy, lots of unnecessary materials, and maybe even materials that are, you know, a little bit bad for your health, why not haul around some straw bales and make it as a good wall, or incorporate some, you know, let's say you've harvested hemp and incorporate that into a hempcrete material, or using cob with straw dabble, or what? There's millions of natural building methods out there which costs a very small percentage of what any conventional home may cost you. And it just feels right. You know, if you've ever been one, you would know what I'm talking about. And these ways of building have been with us for as long as humans have been living on this planet. And obviously this ecological dimension not only includes natural building, but also with the habitat that you create for yourself. Permaculture design, sensible design, using energy in a sustainable manner. And there's millions of opportunities, possibilities within any given situation. And that's where the whole fun and magic comes into this, especially when you're coming into scratch or if you're not. It's fun regardless, and it's healthy, and it just feels right. But next thing we got is the worldview, and that's, you could just think of it as the emerging synthesis of the scientific and spiritual worldviews, a coming together of just a sense of where we're at in this special time of human history, or just of history of just everything, or just this uniqueness of the present day, of the present moment, right here, right now. I don't know about you, but sometimes I just, you know, pause for a minute and just, whoa, man, just get caught up in the wonder of it. It's quite unique, quite incredible to be alive right now. You could also look at this worldview, cultural dimension of Ecovillage Design as just a intentional raising of consciousness and human potential as the most effective means to getting to a truly sustainable way of life. Because you often hear about the triple bottom line, you know, talked about in boring business meetings or whatever, you know, having the integration of economic, social, ecological dimensions, but there's really no juice, no gas in that. In order to really feel what that means, you got to add the spark of the worldview element. It acknowledges and points out, recognizes that there are always underlying, often unspoken, and sometimes hidden patterns to culture that strongly influence and may in fact predetermine these economic, social, and ecological relationships. So when you check out every community, every culture, you'll see that each group seems to be guided, informed, and directed by particular interpretations about this nature of reality, and thus determining their physical reality, because consciousness precedes physicality. But anywho, that's enough of me rambling on there. Let's just get on with the conversation and listen to what Adi has to say about her experiences in West Africa and in Ecovillage creation and transition in that region of the world. So let's go and dive in. Oh, but also before, please leave a review if you like it or if you don't. And we'll greatly appreciate it. And also just reach out to us and maybe even leave a voice message. You could follow the link provided at anchor.fm or just send an email, whatever. Like to hear from you. So anyway, let's go into the conversation. All right. Well, welcome to Ecovillage Library. Thanks for having a chat with me. And what's your full name, by the way? I don't know how to pronounce it.
Ah, it's Adelaide, like the city in Australia.
Oh, okay. Yeah, is that where you're from originally?
No, I'm French, but you can call me Ade, though. Like, everyone calls me Ade.
Ade, okay. Ade, yeah. Well, welcome, Ade. It's a pleasure to have you on here.
Thank you for having me.
So, we originally connected about a project that you're involved with in West Africa called Sobada? Am I pronouncing that right?
Yes.
So what's the project about? How'd you get involved with this? What's the deal?
So basically, so it's a project called Yelema, which means a change in Malinke, which is the local language there in Sobata. So Sobata is a small village in the Republic of Guinea in West Africa. It has about 500 people. And basically, the mission of this project is to support the transition of the village towards more sustainability. Initially, I was on my own with this project, but last year I was involved in an online course with Gaia Education called Design for Sustainability, and I met three women there who are now on board with the project. And four of us, we did a case study on the village. And so we asked ourselves, okay, how can we best support their transition towards sustainability without being, because we are four Europeans, without being post-colonialist about it, without telling them what to do. It was really important for us to make the right choices there. And in the end, we came to the conclusion that the best way to support them was through access to education for resilience. So what we did is that we raised some money through a crowdfunding for to help four people from the village to attend a month-long training in the Gambia called EDE. It stands for Eco-Village Design Education. It's also from Gaia Education, this NGO. And so it's a month-long course where you learn about sustainable practices, regenerative practices in a systematic way, in a holistic approach, where you look at all the areas of sustainability, so ecological, economic, social, and cultural. And so four people from the village were able to attend the course. I was there also with two other women I was working with. So we met in person there. And
they, when was they, this?
It, when was this? Last November, yeah. November 2019.
Oh, wow. Yeah. Oh, okay.
Yeah. And yeah, it was really wonderful for them. They were able to learn so many tools, but also to create their own, to work on their own design project for the village. So yeah, that's how it started. And now we have lots of projects for the year and years to come.
Wow. And what's the vision that you guys have, you and the village? What's the long-term objective?
So, well, I can't really speak for them about it. I mean, we've had chats about it, of course, but it's something we can only imagine for now. Things might change. But with my friend from the design team, when we did this case study and from talking to the people from the village, of course, the idea that we have is that in the long term, Sobata will be like a hub for climate resilience education. We love the idea that they'll be able to hold trainings, courses to help other villages who are facing the same challenges with the change of climate. And how can they restore their water cycle? How can they grow foods in a dry environment and be like an inspiration for many other people? Because like if they can do it with where they are and their situation, everyone can.
Totally. So,
yeah, that's the long-term idea.
And what was the first contact you've had with the village? How did you get personally involved? How did this train start rolling?
So that's an interesting story, actually. So three years ago, I was involved in a translation project in Guinea. So I was working with this guy who actually initially had a mining project. So at the time, like 3 years ago, I was not really like not as environmentally conscious as I am now. And basically what he needed me for was to liaise with the local people, people in Guinea, because the official language is French. And he was speaking English. He needed someone to translate, whether it is on the phone, translating documents, and sort of coordinate the whole project on the ground while, I mean, from the phone though, I was not there. And I thought it was really exciting just because it was very different from what I was doing before. And well, I had no knowledge about mining at the time. And he was telling me, okay, I want to do it in a sustainable way. It was gold mining. I was like, okay, fine, let's see. And so I started doing lots of research about this mining thing. I had no idea what it was about and how it worked. So to get my job done, I had to do research, and I quickly realized, of course, that, well, there is no such thing as sustainable mining, really. It doesn't work like that. And at the same time, I got to know the community. I was speaking to a few people on the phone regularly, and I got to know their daily struggles, what's going on for them. And at some point I had to tell this guy I was working with that it was no longer working for me to support this mining project. I explained to him how it was actually not serving the community to be involved in something like this, that it was not a long-term solution. It was not sustainable. It was going to be damaging at so many levels. And he was actually really cool about it because he's like multi-entrepreneur. He's doing lots of different ventures. And he said, look, we have if you want to be involved still with this community, how about you work on getting some water to them? Because I know, like, you know that they're struggling for water and all of that. And I said, cool, like that sounds really inspiring, exciting. And I started doing some research again. I had no knowledge about like how it works to get water drilling. And that's how I started to realize that actually there is no such thing as just going to one village and drill for water and then just go away and hope, like, think that this problem is going to be resolved. Mm-hmm. In order to do it in the best way, I had to learn how to think about it in a holistic way, because I quickly realized, okay, if tomorrow they have like enough water supply for like everything that they need, they're going to stop queuing, like spending half the day queuing for water, which is like their way to socialize for most women, for example. What are they going to do instead? It's going to really disrupt the, like, just the social canvas that is like been going on for, I don't know how many years, but long, long time. And what's going to happen? What's going to be the consequence? If they have water, but the village nearby doesn't have water, what's going to happen? Like, that might create some conflict or some problems. I realized that I could not really anticipate, like, what was going to happen at the social level, the environmental level also. Like, how are they going to use the water? For what kind of farming? Oh, but what kind of farming are they doing? Or is it monoculture? But if it's monoculture, are they using chemicals? And realizing that there were so many things to think about, I thought, okay, there is no way I can make one decision without having all the cards in my hand. So that's why I joined this Design for Sustainability course with Gaia Education, in order to learn everything I could learn about, like, seeing things in a systemic way, you know? My goal was to be able to do a case study on the village, and so to end up with a solution that would be, like, in my head, like, the best for them, you know? In the end, the conclusion that I had was that just drilling for water was not going to be helpful, because they had nothing in place to actually retain the water that was already there. There was a lot of things that they could already do for much less money and investment. And to go back to what I was saying before, we realized that just an access to education was going to be more valuable to them and more rewarding in the long term. It was going to bring them more resilience.
Okay.
So yeah, I started with this mining project and moved completely away from it. And now I'm just supporting them in whatever direction they want to take after this course that they took last year.
So is the mining project still happening?
No.
So they ceased mining for gold in the area?
No. So it's not happening anymore. This guy I was working with, he needed someone to speak French to be able to carry on. And he just decided to pose it. I don't know if at some point he will try and reach out to someone else, but I'm not sure he will, because he seemed to be pretty convinced by what I was saying to him that it was not going to be sustainable for the community. Although there is a lot of mining that is going on in the area around the village. The Northeast Guinea has a lot of gold. So Bata is surrounded by big mining project, like global companies that are mining for like years and years and years and polluting and creating.
What are some of the major polluting factors, like from their gold mining operations? What was the major pollutants from that?
Right. So, well, they will be the chemicals that you need to use to how do I say that, like, to get the gold out, to extract the gold out, you store it in those, I think it's mercury-based.
Oh,
that you put in, well, basically on the ground, you dig a big basin and you put mercury in it. And of course, it spills out, it infiltrates. So there is that, the fact that, of course, they dig really deep and they have to move communities, like displace them completely. So, of course, what they do is that they rebuild houses for them, but it's not made in traditional materials. Mm. It's possibly they're moved in an area where the soil is not as fertile. They have to start everything again from scratch. They're uprooted from like where their ancestries were buried. It's like really damaging at so many levels. And of course, like the people who come like work there, they are expatriates from, you know, like Canada, Europe, US. And so like the lifestyle that they have is very different. As a result, the local people, like some shops are going to raise their prices because they know that these people can pay for it. But as a result, local people can't pay for it anymore. It just disrupts the life over there at so many levels.
Seems like a common trend. You know, I've seen that throughout Latin America too. Expatriate communities rising the prices, kicking out the locals. Yeah, it's unfortunate. And you said too that they've been drilling for water, like just drilling wells as a way for drinking water. That's what they were doing during the same time, was drilling the ground for groundwater supply for their drinking needs and everything.
You mean the gold companies?
Or for the communities in general. You said drilling for water?
Oh, this guy I was working with suggested me that I could work on finding a solution to drill for water for them, but nothing has happened for this community. Yeah, okay. Yeah.
What is life like there right now in Sopata, but also in West Africa? I know it's a completely different world out there. I've never been there myself. Mm-hmm. How would you describe that, the lifestyle there?
So, I mean, for myself, I can only speak from, I haven't been to Sobata yet. I was supposed to go there this year. And like, who knows with the current situation what's going to happen. But I've been to the Gambia last year for 5 weeks. And so I can, like personally, I can only speak from this short experience. And of course, by talking to the people from the village, I guess there are two things that I would like to talk about. And one, we just started talking about it, is how most people I talk to from Africa, they all tell me about those global exploitation projects that are going on near where they live, that come from, of course, the global north, and that these companies, whatever, if they're drilling for gold, for copper, for diamond, for some like some sand material, like so many different things. There is always like a big, big disruption that's going on for these local communities. There, it creates lots of mistrust for African people to white people. They don't understand, like, they don't understand why the global north is still seeing Africa as a resource country for their use. But in the equation, for these companies who come there and just like take whatever they need, the well-being of communities are just not at all in the equation. They're not part of it. They're not considered. They just happen to be there. You know, when I was working on this mining project, I was shocked to see how easily it is to get a mining permit in Guinea. You just have to give some money and they allocate you a plot of land for you to be able to do whatever you want in there. It doesn't matter if 1, 2, 3 villages, communities are living on there. You can do whatever you want because...
Who allocates the land?
So the state. The state owns the land. And even if there is absolutely no relationship between like the people from remote villages like Sobata and the state, they're completely autonomous, completely self-sufficient. Still, the land belongs to the state. And so they're able to just freely allocate it to whoever, any foreign investor that comes with some money can say, okay, I want to mine over there because I did some mapping and I think gold is over there. It doesn't matter if it's just underneath, you know, a graveyard or a village or, you know, a plot of land that is farmed for, you know, hundreds of years. It doesn't matter. Mm-hmm. So that's one thing that is going on, like from, you know, my understanding in many, many places. And something else, like as a European, I think is really important to point out is when we go to Africa or want to be involved in Africa, we have this bias often that we are rich and they're poor. We have everything and they have nothing. And as a result, we need to do something. But when you go there, at least it's my personal experience, what you realize, and which is really humbling actually, is that they have a richness that we've lost, that we've forgotten about. They still have connection with people, with the earth, the environment in general, with nature. They know how to grow their own food. They are way more autonomous than we are. They have kept this connection with nature, and between people, they are always together. There is no such thing as like not knowing who your neighbor is. In the sense, when I realized that if there was like a catastrophe, like, you know, like something crazy happening on the planet, like a bit like now actually, like who is the most resilient? Is it me who has to go shopping and like in a shop because I'm not growing my own food, or is it them? Who like absolutely, it doesn't matter if all the shops are closed. They are growing their own food anyway. They are totally autonomous. They are not waiting for decisions to be made outside, because they have this like decision making process going on in a village that works really well and is pretty much horizontal. All of those things really shows that they just have a resilience that we don't have, and we need to learn from them and not the other way around.
So what's that decision-making process like? I'm curious to know.
Ah, well, it's really interesting. It's like they will often get together, like if a decision needs to be made, they will get together, gather under a tree, a big tree in the center of a village. Because it's mostly Muslim over there in Sobata, there are often specific roles for women, for men, for youth, elders. They are quite separated, but like quite considered like more or less equally, like in their voice, I mean, in the sense that if a decision is to be made, all the groups are going to be asked what they think. They will ask, okay, the youth, what do you think? The elders, what do you think? You know, men, what do you think? Women, what do you think? And then they will turn around like that, and the chief of the village with his advisors will think about it and make a decision, and then submit it again to the village. Okay, this is the decision we took from everything that you said. Let's make another turn. Do you agree? Yes, no, yes, no. It's really interesting. Everyone gets to say what they think. Everyone is included in the process.
Do you see people interrupting each other when that happens?
Well, I couldn't tell you personally because I haven't witnessed it. It's just stories that I heard from the people I met from the village, but I haven't seen it happening.
And what about the chiefs? How do they find themselves as chiefs? I'm kind of curious about that.
To be honest, I wouldn't be able to tell you about this one. I've learned a little bit about how it's done, for example, in Gambia, where I was in Khartoum, where chiefs are chosen within the two oldest families that first settled in the village. And I don't know how it is exactly for Sobata, actually.
Well, interesting. Well, yeah. I bet still different from our way of choosing leaders.
Oh, yeah.
So my favorite subject of water, let's talk about water. Is there a plan for improving the water supply or making the water supply more resilient? Or what's the current water situation? I know you mentioned drilling for water from the ground. What's happening right now, and what's the plan to come?
Right. So at the moment, in Sobata, there are two wells. In the village, one being used for drinking water and the other one like for the rest, but it's a bit like the water is less safe. It's not safe to drink, really. So the first one has a hand pump. It works slowly, but it does work. And the other one, you need to use a bucket. So it's really like, it's not really efficient. And, as a result, women really like queue for hours and hours just to get water every day. It's actually a really interesting situation in Sobata because on the one hand, you have Guinea, especially Northeast Guinea where Sobata is, which is called the Water Tower of Africa, because of West Africa at least, because so many rivers from West Africa come from Guinea and a mountain just near Sobata called Futa Djallon, which like is the source of so many rivers. And on the other hand, you have those villages in like Sobata who really struggle for water because the land is so dry. What happened is that because, well, of so many factors, like, you know, the weather, the climate change and the use of chemicals for farming because they needed an increase of yield, many things like that. There is a lot of erosion going on. So whenever it does rain, it rains about 4 months of the year, but it rains a lot. The water doesn't penetrate, doesn't infiltrate the soil at all. It just like washes off. So it doesn't nourish the soil, the plants, and it's basically useless. It's even like complicated because it creates problems on roads and things like that. So one of the key informations that the people from Sobata learned in the EDE when they went to the Gambia is how to keep that water on their land when it does come by slowing it down for a start, retaining it through mulching and other techniques. And so it can then infiltrate and penetrate, stay in the ground to, in the long term, just restore the water table and have like more water in the wells and things. For example, there is a river that like is just flows near Sobata. It's dry most of the year, but during the rainy season, it's really going, but there is nothing in place to take some water out and just have it drain towards the gardens, for example, or like little dams to slow it down. Nothing is done at the moment. And that's really one of the projects for this year that they want to put in place before the rainy season starts. They want to put all of that in place so when the water comes, when the rain comes, it will really nourish the soil. And as a result, they'll be able to grow food longer when the rainy season stopped. The soil will stay, you know, will have more moist, and they'll be able to extend this season where they can grow crops.
So I'm sure they have plans now for earthworks then this year, I'm assuming, to be able to hold that water in key locations.
Well, it's like in plans. We will need funding, of course, for that to be able to support them. Like there are lots of things they can do on their own, like the whole like mulching. There is plenty of small projects that are going on, but for like big earthwork, like you're talking about, that's one of those things that we'll try and get funding for, like to support them.
Have you ever heard of Tamara Eco Village?
Yeah, of course. Yeah,
oh,
yeah.
Oh man, such a great
amazing,
inspiration.
It's amazing the lake that they created out of nowhere.
Oh,
yeah,
yeah,
I know. They did that also. Well, in much smaller version in Damanhur, the Italian eco village.
Mm.
Yeah, yeah. And I was there last summer, and they showed us this pond that they did landscaped, because they had the guy who designed the one in Tamara. He came over and landscaped it for them.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. It's really inspiring, and it's definitely something like that.
By the way, did you go see the caves in Damanhur?
No. Oh, my God. Everyone, I really wanted to, and at the time I couldn't, because when it was scheduled, I arrived a little bit too late. But I really hope, like, it's not that far from where I live, actually. Like, there are buses. Yeah. Have you been there?
I have not. I've been in Tamara, but I haven't been to Damanhur. But I hear a lot of good things, and I want to go visit one day.
Yeah, I've seen the pictures. They're awesome.
So now what about the food? What are they currently doing for their agricultural needs? What are they producing? What are they growing? Or do they have to import a lot? What's the situation now for Sobata?
So Sobata is pretty much self-sufficient. They grow, their main crops are corn and peanuts. It's really like the base of their food most of the time. And sometimes for like celebrations, they have like rice, but it's really, really not often. Same for special occasions, they will have chicken, but most of the time it's really just this corn-based products and peanut-based products also. And they have small gardens. So peanuts and corn, it's their monocrops, like main big fields. It's where they would use chemicals and things like that, for now at least, to increase the yields. And so men are in charge of that mostly. And women have like small gardens where they do grow vegetables, like you see, lots of beans, potatoes, aubergines, but in smaller quantities. They also have access to a food market, which is in the nearest village, where they like can get things that they don't grow in their village. But mostly this is what they grow. And there is a project this year that they started as soon as they got back to the village after the course, which is a community garden. Their idea was that with everything that they learned, they wanted to implement permaculture principles. They want to move away from pesticides and chemicals, and they thought the best way to do it was to create this garden where they would do all those trials in order to show, like, to prove to the community that it does work, that it's not like just an idea, but it's working. And they managed to involve about 50 people from the community who are now working on this garden, planting fruit trees. They finished fencing it, and now they're going to plant lots of things. It's really exciting.
Wow, I love hearing stories like that, or new projects underway like that. That's awesome. And what about, does anybody recall a time where the standard way of living was different or more in harmony with their surroundings?
Yeah, actually, we had the opportunity to talk about this during the ED, during the training, about more traditional ways of living in different areas. Like, for example, when we're talking about money, the people from Sabata remembered that in the past, when they were children, the village was less dependent on the Guinean money, and they would used to trade things, trade in food, in cattle, in other things that they did have. Like, if they wanted to, for example, go see a movie, like there was this thing going on in the nearest village where you could watch a movie. Well, to get in, you have to give some peanuts, for example.
Oh. No way.
It was really interesting to see, like, that they had a whole trading system going on that was completely outside of money. And so they were really interested in exploring how they could go back to something like that to increase their resilience. Also, talking to one of the guys whose mom is the only midwife in the village, she has an extensive knowledge on, like, natural remedies and how to use all the plants that are growing around the village to treat patients for healing and all of that. And he learned a lot of it. And he was saying that it's a shame that at the moment this knowledge is getting lost more and more. And so there was a time where they really didn't rely on drugs and pills. And they had like natural treatments for everything. And it was working well.
What are they using now for currency or a way of exchange?
You mean like the Guinean currency?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Is that what they're using?
Yeah, yes, the Guinean franc, which is really low in a way that, like, for like 10 euros, you have like so many notes. It doesn't make any sense anymore, actually. The more it goes year after year, you need to have like so much money, so much notes just to pay for a small thing. And because of what we're talking about before, the fact that everything is becoming more expensive because of the expatriates living in similar areas, and it's really not beneficial for the local community. So yeah, like they really understood, and they're thinking about solutions to increase their resilience again by, you know, like going back to this trading system where, like, if any, you know, someone needs something, well, how can I give it to you, either with like giving you something that I do have that you don't, that I grow that you don't grow, or just by giving time, for example, time in your fields or for something else.
Hmm. Have you been to Finnhorn Eco Village yet?
No, not yet. Yeah, I really want to go there.
It's really cool. They've created their own currency notes too. So it was like one-on-one exchange to the British pound. But when I was there, you know, you were able to use their, they call it the ecos, I think, from what I remember, and you within the community and also within some of the surrounding towns, you could use that currency as a way of exchange. It was pretty cool. A good inspirational example for other.
Yeah, definitely. I think it's really a great way to keep the economy at the local level.
Totally. Yeah. And I know we've talked a little bit about the culture's way of life in the area. Is there other uniqueness of their culture or way of living or the spirituality or anything that kind of stood out to you personally?
What I found really interesting when I would ask them, okay, why is money still important for you? Why do you think that you need money, like the Guinean money? And they would always come back to the same thing and say, well, when there is a wedding, when there is a naming ceremony, something like that, we need to be able to have our best clothes. We need to be able to bring a gift. We need to be able to cook a special meal. For them, it's really a way to honor the special celebration, to be able to put a big effort in whatever they're going to, whether it is how they're going to dress or what they're going to bring or how they're going to organize it. And I found this really special. But I have to say, because I haven't lived there yet, I can't say much more about their unique traditions.
So now imagine that somebody listening to this is a multi-billionaire, multimillionaire, whatever, and I was like, all right, let me just send $1 million this way. And you found yourself responsible for the allocation of this. How would it be spent to achieve the objective long-term vision of Subhata?
That's so exciting. Just the idea of it. Well, the idea that we had with the village was to organize. So what was going on is that the people who came to the course last year were only men. And the reason it was like that was because only men were able to speak French in the village, because just they had more opportunity to study than women. And of course, we see it as a problem, and they do also as well, actually. But as a result, we would love for most of the community to be able to benefit from a permaculture training. So our goal for this year was to organize a permaculture course at the end of the year in the village for everyone, but mostly for the women. So that will be one thing, the first thing we would use the money for. And thinking long term in the village, I imagine, well, to rehabilitate the wells and just making sure that the water coming from there is safe and easy to get. The ideas that people from the village had was to create also a traditional health center in order to, like we talked about, to bring back this traditional wisdom and knowledge on, you know, traditional remedies. So, and also to have a place for women to give birth in the village, because there is no such thing as a moment. And also finally, building of a training center in the village to hold courses, whether it is on permaculture, on climate resilience in general. Yeah.
So becoming a central hub for the area to come and learn about resiliency within that bioregion.
Absolutely.
Well, that sounds wonderful. Hopefully that will become reality.
That will be amazing.
And what are you up to now these days? What's life looking like for you?
Well, actually, in relation to this, and after the course in the Gambia, I realized that I really would like to be involved in sharing sustainability practices myself. And I've noticed that there is not much available in French yet. For example, this course that I did on Gaia Education, it's not available in French yet.
Really?
I know. It's available in English, Spanish, Portuguese. I've been talking to them, harassing them, saying, please let me help you translate because I'm a translator. And, well, it's not happening at the moment. And, I think it could be really wonderful. It could be a great thing to have. And so I was wondering if I could create something myself, like an online school to offer short courses, because, those long courses are really expensive. And, I would like to have all this information made, like, you know, more easily available. So that's a project that I have that I'm trying to create right now.
Awesome.
Yeah, that's it. And there was also something going on this year. We'll see if it can happen. But I was supposed to go again to the Gambia in October because there was supposed to be the GEN conference there. You know, the Global Ecovillage Network conference from the GEN Africa conference. In the Gambia, so I was going to go and volunteer a month before to help setting it up. We were thinking about organizing a training of trainers also over there with Gaia Education also. And since I've done one myself, I was really interested in volunteering to help setting it up in this African context. So yeah, let's see if it can happen. It would be really amazing if I could go back there again.
Can't see why not, how all that can't be possible.
We'll see.
So now the trademark question, if you were to be any animal in the world, what would you be and why?
You know, I thought about it, and there was one animal that came to mind straight away, and then I was like, oh no, I can't possibly say that. But then I decided that yeah, it made more sense. So I love to be a jellyfish.
All right.
Right. So it's interesting. Like, why is it that I started to be interested in this animal is that when I was younger, I studied textile design. And during the studies, I did some research on fashion trends and why is it that people end up being drawn to some patterns or some colors? Why is it that we're interested in this type of shape, like for our clothes? And then like 10 years later, it's not the case anymore. Why this pattern? Why that pattern? And there is a whole like area that's going on in fashion, which is, I don't know if you've seen that, around like deep sea jellyfish, mermaids, all those transparent, translucent, fluorescent colors going on. And in doing research on why, like emotionally, psychologically, we are drawn to patterns like that, for me, it's because we need to, when we look at our life and how challenging it can be sometimes, how sometimes meaningless also, and busy, 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 we need an escape and something like far away to think about. Like, why is it that everyone is fascinated by galaxy patterns? It's the same. For me, it's the same thing. Whether it is like deep sea mermaids, fictional characters, really weird colors like that, or really far away space galaxy patterns, it's this escape, like this need to dream in order to balance our sometimes complicated life, daily life. Mm-hmm. So yeah, that's why I really like a jellyfish. I would have said mermaid, but you know, not real, so I can't. I guess it doesn't count.
Well, you never know. All right. How can the listeners see what you're up to these days and learn more about Sobata and how to get involved or donate or whatever? What's a go-to location?
Well, actually, at the moment, we are slowly but surely building a blog/website for the project, but it's not on yet. So at the moment, I would advise people to go follow the Instagram page. So it's yelema.project, yelema, yelema.project. You have also there the link to our crowdfunding. It was for the course that happened at the end of last year, but it's still open for any project. We will start a new one probably this year, but in the meantime, you can still donate if you want to support the project on the page that you'll see on Instagram, and we update it regularly, I mean, as much as we can on what's been going on. So now I'll be posting about this community garden that is taking shape more and more. We will see also if it happens. There's supposed to be the Global Ecovillage Network conference in Europe this July in Germany. We're supposed to go there and have a workshop to talk about the training that we did last November. So that will be an opportunity to bring the project, the Sobata project, and to do some networking and to talk about what's going on over there. Just to weave it into the sustainability network. So yeah, you can also meet us at the conference.
All right.
Yeah.
Well, this is an awesome conversation. I loved hearing about all this. This is awesome.
Yeah, thank you. It was really nice to share.
All right, Ade. Well, we got to do this again sometime.
Absolutely.
And hear how progress is going.
Yeah, definitely.
Buddy, that's all, folks. Show Ade all your love. Reach out to her, support her. And if you got the financial means, please help her progress further with
that project. And yeah, that's about it. I hope you guys enjoy the episode. Don't forget to leave a review on whichever platform you found it on, or reach out to us, write to us at ecovillagelibrary@gmail.com. And till next time, ciao, ciao.